The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPont.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on the account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. This is the 19th Amendment, and it is deceptively simple and straightforward because the road to get to this addition to the U.S. Constitution was anything but. It was long, it was brutal, complex, with twists and turns and betrayals. How did we get to the 19th Amendment with the recognition of the woman's right to vote? And what does this mean today? How did this become a transformational event for the United States? If you have any questions or comments about the 19th Amendment and the woman's right to vote, give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And you can also email your questions and comments to thesource at tpr.org and tweet at us at tprsource. We're joined this hour with Elaine Weiss. She's an award-winning journalist and author of The Women's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. And Sally Rush Wagner is a lecturer, author, and editor of the book The Women's Suffrage Movement. Welcome both of you. Great to have you here this afternoon.
Thanks, David.
Elaine, I'm going to ask you first. I want to hear from both of you probably on everything. I want to make this a free-flowing conversation. It seems like most people have a very fuzzy, faint sketch in their minds about how the 19th Amendment was finally ratified and women were able to get the recognition of the right to vote. Why is that? Why don't we have a better understanding, particularly since this is such a gripping narrative?
You're right that most Americans, and I should say I would include myself in that group until I started doing my research, really have no idea how women achieved the vote. What's usually in our textbooks, if there's anything at all, again, this is the largest expansion of the franchise, the largest expansion of democracy in our history. And it usually comes down in our school textbooks to, and in 1848, women met at Seneca Falls and asked for the vote. And then fast forward, in 1920, women were given the vote. And they were not given the vote. We were not given the vote. It took, as you mentioned in your introduction, 7 decades, 3 generations, over 900 state, local, and national campaigns. It was a bitter, difficult fight. And I think we don't know it because we've not been taught it in school. It's not been considered a large part of our history. I think that with the centennial coming up in 2020, books like Sally's, books like mine, will begin to give the public a sense of what this took, how large a step it was, how brave the women who fought for it were, how conflicted the movement was. It's a very complicated, important chapter in our history, and I think it's great to bring it back into the public conversation.
And Sally Rush Wagner, what do you think?
Absolutely agree with Elaine. It is much more complicated. And I think we can actually date it to before 1848. Women had political voice on this land at least 1,000 years ago. The Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederacy, founded on the shores of Onondaga Lake 1,000 years ago. And the clan mothers from that date to today continue to nominate the chiefs, hold them in their positions, remove them if necessary, and one of the requirements is that the man cannot have abused a woman. That continues today, and those women inspired some of the earliest feminists, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Matilda Joslyn Gage.
And that comes to the point when we talk about the 19th Amendment and that women were not given the right to vote. And we say sometimes that they won the right to vote, but women always had the right to vote. What was achieved was a recognition and the lifting of a prohibition of the ability to vote. Elaine Weiss?
Well, I'm not sure I would agree that women possessed an inherent right to vote. That was contested in the courts throughout the decades of the movement. I think that that's probably not accurate. There, it was not a prohibition. It was many state constitutions said that men could vote, and often it also said white men.
Sure, but I'm putting forth a philosophical point of view.
Ah, okay. I was being a little legalistic there. Yes, it was certainly that women were not considered for the vote, and Sally is perfectly right that this was being discussed way before Seneca Falls. Seneca Falls is that first sort of organized meeting, even if it was organized 5 days in advance. It's the first organized meeting when women stand up and demand the franchise. And I think that the whole movement is about changing the laws, changing those prohibitions that didn't allow women to vote.
But we talk about our rights in ways that they're inalienable, they're deemed by God, and that we have a compact with our government, that our government gets its legitimacy through the being accepted or given its power by the people that are governed. It is one of the founding parts of our government. And so that never changed. It's just that the women were excluded from being able to have a political voice. Sally Rush Wagner?
Yes, and of course they did vote in the colonies on occasion when property was the qualification. And if a woman was single, widowed, had enough property, she could vote in some of the colonies. So the suffragists were asking, they said, not for a new right, but for the restitution of a right that our foremothers had. And as Aline said, it was the state constitutions after the Revolution that one by one denied women and African American men the right to vote. The suffragists, I think, would have agreed with you, David, in saying the National Woman Suffrage Association, anyway, said, we have the right to vote in a government based on the consent of the governed. We have the right. We are not the lawbreakers. When we go to the polls and vote, as they did, they carried on a campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience that included refusing to pay their taxes, no taxation without representation, and voting. And they said that the registrars that refused to let them vote were the lawbreakers, and the states that denied them the right to vote were the lawbreakers. So the National Woman Suffrage Association, which was the branch of the movement that focused on the federal amendment, absolutely agreed. The American Woman Suffrage Association, and these two groups existed from 69 to 89, and the Americans said, nope, the states get to decide who can vote. So there was a difference there in terms of strategy. But definitely the more progressive wing of the movement said we do have the right to vote.
We're talking about the 19th Amendment and the struggle for women's suffrage, how women were able to achieve the recognition of their right to vote. If you can call in with a question or a comment, the number is 210-614-8980. It may sound like we're talking about ancient history to you, but this is very relevant to today, and it'll be very relevant to the big election coming up next year because it'll be the centennial of the vote. 210-614-8980. The source continues. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about women's suffrage and the 19th Amendment. There was a time in the United States where women were seen as dead in the eyes of the law, as akin to being intellectually feeble, unable to make decisions for themselves, unable to have property, completely in the power of their fathers and husbands. What changed? Why did it take so long? Why such a struggle in order to achieve equality at the ballot box? If you got a question or a comment, the number is 210-614-8980. Elaine Weiss, what was the life of a woman like when this fight was going on?
Well, when the movement really begins to get traction in the middle of the 19th century, as you mentioned, a woman was considered a married woman was the property of her husband. She had no property rights. If she had an inheritance or any kind of wages, they belonged to her husband. Her children belonged to her husband. She had no custodial rights. She had no right to bring suit in a court of law or to testify, even to testify on her own behalf. She could not serve on a jury. She could not then be judged by a jury of her peers. She could not, it was actually considered totally immoral for women to speak publicly. And if a woman did get up, as the abolitionists did, and then the suffragists, a woman standing up in an audience that included men, it was considered promiscuous. That's how the term was used. So a woman had to be extremely brave to stand up and publicly assert her ideas of political and social equality. And when you asked about why did it take so long, I think it was because it was more than a political decision. This wasn't just about getting the right to vote. This was going to mark a change of social and cultural and for some religious significance, because there were opponents to suffrage right to the very end in 1920 who believed that a woman demanding equality with men on a political basis or social basis went against God's plan, because God, in their view, had made woman to be subservient to man, Eve to Adam. And so to assert your equality went against biblical teaching. And that was used as an argument. So you can see there are these levels, these really strong levels of cultural and moral and religious teaching that the suffragists are having to confront. So it's not just the political issue, which was complicated enough, the idea of women going to the ballot box and expressing their views, which scared the daylights out of the political parties. But it was also a much more complex emotional reaction. This was going to affect the American family. It was going to, as the anti-suffragists said, bring about the moral downfall of the nation.
And Sally Rush Wagner, let's go back to the question of like how women lived under those rules and under that type of society, and how did they manage, particularly seeing how they had no rights, they had no voice, but they're completely actualized, they're people. How do they do that?
Well, I think Elaine laid out so well exactly what the position was. I think by the mid-1850s, there had begun to be some movement. For example, Texas in 1840, which was still an independent republic, gave extensive financial rights to married women. And other southern states and northern states followed, 1848 in New York, for example. So there was beginning to be a movement for a woman to become economically independent in some ways. There also had been the sort of groundwork laid by the female anti-slavery societies. First one formed by African-American women in 1832 in Boston, and then by 1837 they had organized African-American and white women into a national organization, about over 100 different local organizations. And this was where women really got their political voice. They began to learn how to organize. They developed some political savvy. And so they bring this into the women's rights movement. It also, women had been speaking in public and sort of, you know, broke the ground for the suffragists then in that case as well. So by the time they organized nationally in Worcester in 1850, the women's rights movement does have some legs.
What was the great rationale against women's suffrage, Sally Rush Wagner?
Well, I think Elaine laid it out. One of the basic things was it was not just the vote. It was personhood. Completely. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Joslyn Gage, the two major theorists of the movement, both pointed out the way in which canon law, based on the Bible, the sin of Eve, woman is to be under the authority of man, that goes all the way to St. Paul in the New Testament. And so when that gets translated, canon law, into common law, it is really rigidly codified by Blackstone right before the American Revolution. And the U.S. government actually adopts the Blackstone Code. But that was the basis, that woman is to be non-existent once she married. The two shall become one, and the one is the man. The woman is obedient to the man. So, yes, as Elaine said, God's divine plan would be overthrown. So the religious argument behind it was a very strong one. And then, as Elaine said, the social, the political, should this even be something that we should expand to women? If men are already representing women, then, why do women need to be at the polls?
But weren't there economic interests trying to prevent the women's vote as well, Elaine Weiss? Like the liquor industry, they were afraid of prohibition. The railroads, they had a grip on Washington, D.C. They were afraid that could be loosened.
Oh, yes. I think one of the most interesting aspects of my research was to realize that women's suffrage, which if we think of it at all, we think of it as this isolated movement that only involved women, which is not true at all. It was buffeted by every political and economic and social wind that was passing through America in the 19th and 20th centuries. And so what you see is that there's corporate interest in whether women can vote. And for the most part, the corporate interests are opposed to it because they believe that women will be bad for their bottom line. So you mentioned the railroads. They needed favors from Congress and favors from the state legislatures. And often they had a lot of sway, a lot of money to pass around. And it was well known in states like Tennessee, where the pivotal last battle takes place, that they owned the legislature. And they feared that if women came in and voted on their own, they might not elect the candidates they'd already bought. It would be expensive. And so they're opposing women's suffrage. One of the most interesting corporate opponents were the textile manufacturers, who feared that if women, especially mothers, could vote, they might want to abolish child labor. And these factories depended on child labor because it was cheap. So it was going to be a bad impact on their bottom lines if women voted to abolish child labor. And the liquor industry, of course, it's a very fascinating and complicated relationship, because many suffragists, especially the leaders, were also active in the temperance movement. And this was, for some, a moral issue, but for many more, it was really a domestic violence issue. This was to protect women from abusive husbands, and to their idea was if you restrict the ability to buy liquor, that would help the domestic situation. And remember, women had very few rights to protect themselves.
I'm going to get to a caller right now. Let's go to Dorothy. And the number is 210-614-8980. Dorothy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've always been so fascinated and about how the women worked this because of the few rights they had. This was in the days starting in 1848, at least. A horse and buggy, maybe a few had access to train rides from city to city, but they wrote longhand. They submitted petitions to the U.S. Congress with tens of thousands of signatures that had been collected over years, some of them. Their tenacity, their perseverance, their determination, their courage with all of the opposition and all the arrest and the forced feeding and put in prison and things thrown at them, and I'm sure many women beaten at home. We didn't kill anybody. Women didn't kill anybody during this fight for the right to vote. Women didn't rape anybody. Nobody burned any businesses down. Nobody shot anybody. They just kept on keeping on collectively, more and more joining the fight because their desire to have their rights as a citizen of the United States, they were so focused. And I admire them and appreciate them so much, as should every other woman in this country.
Dorothy, thank you so much for the call. Sally Rush Wagner, can you, she mentions a lot there, but I really want to get to the point that she made about the difficulty of accumulating this petition, which I think at the time was the largest petition ever put forth in the United States, all done before Facebook.
Well, Dorothy, that was inspiring, I think, to all of us. We do need to really, I think, recognize the accomplishment of these women and their male allies against terrible odds. I think the petition you may be referring to, David, is the one that the national, the feminists that had organized in the 1850s. They held yearly conventions. And they decided once the Civil War began that they would suspend their activities and work instead to end slavery. Now, they said they would support the war effort, but not for the reasons that Lincoln at that time said the war was being fought. He said it was being fought to preserve the Union, and they gathered 400,000 signatures on petitions saying, we will support this war effort as long as it is being fought to end slavery. So during that time period, they suspended their own work, and they worked for the rights of African American enslaved people.
It gives you an idea how long this took, because it encompasses the Civil War and then World War I as well. That gives you sort of the bookends of how long, and those wars, those efforts were instrumental in defining the drive for the 19th Amendment. Sally Rush Wagner. Mm-hmm.
I think usually we date it from 1848. That's the first locally organized convention, or even if we date it from 1850, the national. It's 70 to 72 years of organized struggle. Of course, the issue of the vote had been on the table for, it never got off the table. I think there were always people talking about it. And for example, a Unitarian minister, Samuel J. May, in 1845, when the New York State Constitutional Convention had looked at the possibility of woman suffrage and had denied it. And he preached a fiery sermon that Sunday, and he said, how would you men feel if your wives made every decision for you? Well, that's how your wives feel. And he admonished the men. He said, you men need to become more Christ-like, and you women need to become more aggressive. So it was a fight that was fought both by women and their male allies.
Right, and we should mention that Frederick Douglass was an instrumental male ally in this as well. We're taking a break. The number to call in if you've got a question or a comment, a story to tell about women's suffrage, how this movement is relevant to today's issues. The number is 210-614-8980. We have women's marches. We have concerns. We have the ERA. We're going to talk about that. 210-614-8980. The source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the woman's right to vote, the battle for suffrage, how that was achieved. We're talking with Elaine Weiss. She's the author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, and also Sally Rush Wagner. She is the editor of the book, The Women's Suffrage Movement. Let's go to the phones, 210-614-8980. Leela. Hi, Leela. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, David. I was wondering if your guests could address the role that Quaker thought played in forming the women's suffrage movement, as several of the leaders were Quakers or married to Quakers.
Leela, thank you for the question. Quaker involvement, Sally Rush Wagner?
Yes, absolutely. I think from the beginning, if we're looking at the female anti-slavery societies heavily populated with Quaker women, the Seneca Falls Convention, if we look at the founders of that, there were five women. Four of them were Quaker women who were veterans of the female anti-slavery societies and well versed in organizing. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, of course, was the other caller of the Seneca Falls Convention. I think the Quaker women have a special role, and it's an interesting one because Lucretia Mott initially was opposed to the voting resolution in Seneca Falls. And I think, contrary to what many historians have seen that as a conservative failure of nerve, it was really because the Friends at that point opposed the they would not take part in the government because it was based on violence. It was based on, the principle that it had the right to go to war. And as pacifists, they did not believe in that. So at that point, members of the Friends were, the male members were not voting. They were not voting or running for public office. And so Lucretia Mott took that stand. But her position was, even though I may not want to vote, I will not stand in the way of any woman who wants to vote.
Now, looking at it locally here in San Antonio, Eleanor Brackenridge was instrumental in doing the local fight here in San Antonio and in Texas for the woman's right to vote. And she was the first woman to register to vote here in Bexar County. She may have been the first in the state. I have been able to confirm that. Texas won the woman's right to vote, was able to get it recognized a year before the national ratification. And Texas also ratified, was the ninth state to ratify the amendment that was on June 28th, 1919. So, Elaine Weiss, there, it was happening on the national scale, but also on a local scale. The local heroes need to be remembered as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the exciting things about the centennial observance is that there's lots of research being done at the local level to bring out the voices, not only of the local suffrage organization leaders, and there are many, and they are persistent and ingenious and indefatigable. They are just amazing women and go on to be political and civic leaders in their states, but also the minority women who were the African American women, the Chicano women, the Native American women who are working in their communities and have not been recognized because, frankly, those documents are harder to find. You're not going to find them, as Sally knows, in the history of women's suffrage, those six volumes which tell the victor's story, which is great, but does not include all the voices. And so one of the things I'm excited about is having those voices be dug out of the archives and become part of the public record and the public conversation. But certainly women in every state were involved. That's what's such an amazing aspect of this fight. It was not just at the national level or at the federal level. There were referenda, state referenda, to change the constitutions of the different states that went on from the 1870s right through the 1920s, 50 years of fighting state battles, and in some places, city battles. There were certain cities which would give women the vote in sort of municipal elections that they had some control over. But yes, it's the states that have control over voting rights, which is part of the problem we have today with some states not respecting voting rights. And what the suffragists realized early on, the National Association and then the National Women's Party, which comes up as a more radical voice in the movement, and it says, you know, we're never going to get all these states to give us the vote. There will be states that will never want to give their women the vote. The only way to allow all women in every state, in every election, the vote is a federal constitutional amendment. And so they are working on two tracks, which means that women in every state have to be fighting at the same time. And then, of course, they all have to be fighting in their different states for ratification, which has to be approved by 3/4 of the states of the Union in 1920. That's 36 of the 48 states.
Back to the phones, 210-614-8980. If you got a question or a comment or story to tell us about women's suffrage and how this movement is relevant to today's issues. Rose is on the line. Hi, Rose. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I listen often. I'm glad to participate in the discussion. You mentioned temperance earlier. So the thinking about at the late 1700s, when there was the move from the agrarian lifestyle and family-run home farm businesses to industrial things where men were sent off to work and then sometimes paid with alcohol, the impact that had on the domestic violence. And so I was just wondering if your guest had any comments on that.
Rose, thank you so much. And you also paint a very good picture about this was happening during the Industrial Revolution and great changes in our society at the time. Elaine Weiss, can you talk about how all these things converged onto this battle?
Absolutely. Again, the suffrage is affected by so many streams of historical and political thought. So yes, absolutely, we're changing from an agrarian to a more industrialized nation. People are moving into the cities. There's also the enormous immigration flow into the nation at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th, millions and millions of new Americans. And this affects the suffrage movement too. It affects their the votes in different states because what tends to happen is many immigrant men are given the vote upon being naturalized, and some of them vote against giving their wives and daughters the vote. So it's a very interesting, complex relationship between immigration and the suffrage movement, but it's certainly something that also have the breakup of some of the corporate trusts, but yet you have this concentration of corporate power that in opposition to suffrage, and also the whole idea of what women's role in society is going to be. We have women who are now getting higher education. The Seven Sister colleges for women have been established. They're able to go to state universities. The idea that a woman is a feeble, nervous, unable to do deep thinking kind of individual is beginning to wear away. That whole idea that a woman, if she studied too hard, and this was definitely medical wisdom in the late 19th century, if a woman studied too hard or was forced to think too hard, like on election day, her blood flow would go from her to her brain and would leave her reproductive organs starved. And this might affect her reproductive capabilities, and the whole species was going to be in jeopardy. So this is the kind of thinking that the suffragists had to confront and refute. And so there are so many modern ideas of modernism that are affecting the movement, and they have to confront them on all sides.
At Sally Rush Wagner, there was an effort to demonize women who were fighting for the right. How did they do that?
Oh, well, I think one thing, they were called suffragettes, which was the term used in Britain, but it was a term of derision in the U.S. I think they were defined as godless, as outside the social order. Depending on the different time periods, it actually it became more respectable toward the end. But in the beginning, the male supporters were called henpecked. They were, when Belva Lockwood ran for president in 1884, the men would wear Mother Hubbards, the loose dresses, and march in the streets in a sort of a parody of a woman thinking that she could be president of the United States.
So they were ridiculed, they were humiliated, they were also beaten in the streets. Some were put in prison, and then when they were in prison, they were force-fed. That is a form of torture. It doesn't really describe it well enough when we say force-fed. It means that they shoved the nozzle down their nose, up their nose, down their esophagus, into the stomach, and fed that way. That is officially a form of torture, and this happened in this battle. We don't recognize the how much it took for these heroes of the 19th Amendment in order to achieve this victory. What questions or comments do you have about the 19th Amendment and the women's suffrage movement? When we come back, we're going to talk about where we are today with the Equal Rights Amendment. Is it too late for ratification of the ERA? What lessons can we learn from the fight for women's suffrage? The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about women's suffrage movement and what it took to win the 19th Amendment, the recognition of a woman's right to vote in the United States. Let's go to another caller, 210-614-8980, and this is Michael. Michael, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was calling to comment on the women's right to vote and the struggle that it underwent at that time. But women have always been under a struggle. In this country, it has been a male-dominated country with, especially where I grew up in West Texas, with defined roles for women and men. And many times, women's rights have been violated under the pretense of protecting them, much like they were too fragile to vote. They couldn't make decisions about their own reproduction. In Florida, it was against the law for a woman to serve on a jury until 1960s. So I just wanted to hear your commentator's opinion about that.
Well, Michael, thank you for your call. And Sally Rush Wagner, your reaction?
Well, I think when we look at the women's suffrage movement, we can look at it specifically as the work for the vote, but it was actually much broader than that. They were raising the issues that we continue to raise today, almost all of them. For example, equal pay for equal work was sort of an old adage by the 1850s. Some of the very progressive women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Joslyn Gage and others believed in reproductive justice. And their idea was this, that they believed in the rights of the unborn. And they said the most sacred right of all is the right of every child to be chosen and wanted. And no child should be born through force or through coercion, either of law or of church.
Now, the ERA,
so
the equal...
really raised and pushed the envelope in all of those areas. And I think the caller is absolutely right. It was not... it's the context that Elaine was talking about of this is the position of a woman. She is second class. She is to be under the authority of men. And that's the legacy that we have in the West.
Got an email from Stephen. He wants us to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment. He wants to know if it's too late and would ratification make a difference according to like what we have today? Do women basically have equal rights and would an amendment make a change in their daily life? Elaine Weiss.
Well, I think what's fascinating to think about is that the Equal Rights Amendment was drafted and introduced into Congress in 1923 by Alice Paul, and who of course had led the National Women's Party in the suffrage fight. Also her lieutenants, Sue White, who I write about, she's there in Nashville, Tennessee in 1920, fighting for ratification in her home state of Tennessee, and Crystal Eastman. And all these women have gone to law school in the interim between 1920's ratification and 1923. And they say, okay, we have the vote now. First step is done. Now we go to the next set of challenges, which is equality under the law in all other aspects, education, economics, ability to serve. So it's the whole spectrum of women's rights that they're after. And the fact that it is introduced into Congress just gives you the sense of these were feminists. They were suffragists for the first step, and now they are feminists working for women's rights on a larger scale. And Alice Paul and some of her lieutenants dedicate the next 50 years of their lives. Alice Paul lived into the 1970s. To trying to get the ERA passed in Congress. It stood there stalled for more than 50 years, which is even longer than the 19th Amendment was stalled in Congress. That was only 40 years. And it finally comes out in the 1970s. It does not reach ratification on the first try. There is that deadline is legal is really an interesting question that's being debated right now. And then the deadline is extended. It still falls short of ratification. And there's a push now to get the 38th state, which would be the three-quarter mark. It has failed recently in Virginia to get both houses. One house did approve, the second house did not. And so it's a very interesting question of if we were able to get that 38th state, what would Congress do? Would it accept those? It would probably go to the courts. I think what's the most interesting answer to whether we still need an E3, a lot for the better, but as Justice says, those laws are statutes. Those improvements are by statutory law, and they can be rescinded. So we really do need a constitutional law to bolster and to protect women's rights.
The 19th Amendment, when it was ratified, it went to the Supreme Court also, but it was challenged and it ruled unanimously that the 19th Amendment would stand. But it's interesting, it's always a fight. It's never going to be easy. And and I think that's the problem that we have with history. There's this bias and illusion of inevitability. People now today will think, well, of course we have a woman's right to vote because they've always known it to be that way, but it really was a struggle. And I wonder sometimes by having that sort of cavalier attitude about what we have today sort of makes us take things for granted. Do you think there is a feeling that we don't really understand the gravity of a woman's right to vote, Sally Rush Wagner?
I think part of the problem with this is the way in which we're taught history in schools. We're taught the great men, great wars, and even if we change it to women, we're often taught that it's individuals who really make the course of history transformed. And it isn't. It's movements. You know, Lincoln didn't free the slaves. It was the abolition movement that pushed him to that position, as well as other things going on. But if there hadn't been an anti-slavery movement, would there have really been an end to enslavement in the country, in at least in the degree that it was in the time that it was? So I think that if we're taught that there was this thing that happened, it's inevitable, it was done, over, there's nothing else we need to work on. We're not taught that the women raised the issue of equal pay 150 years ago when it was women making half the wages men made. And, you know, if we look at that today, 150 years later, we're a little bit above 75%. Well, at this rate, it's 150 years before pay equity. I think that historic understanding that it's a flow and we're part of that flow, and the history is what we make it. It's how we create it.
Now, in the last presidential election, the current president lost the women's vote by quite a bit. And there was, it was kind of a joke, and it was floating around a hashtag, repeal the 19th. People were saying that that was a mistake. Sally Rush Wagner, are you aware of this repeal the 19th hashtag?
I think that we should really look at how the vote came down by different groups of women. African American women voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton, and white women voted over 50% for Donald Trump. And I think that that really gets to the issue of the racism of the movement and the voter suppression that grew out of the movement and was part of that, that African American women really didn't begin to vote and have the at least access to voting, even though they may have had the legal protection. They didn't have the right to go to the polls and vote until the 1960s, nor did African American men. And I think that that has changed the nature of the voting patterns. You know, part of the reason that those voter suppression laws are in place are because of the women's suffrage movement. And at the same time that we have much to celebrate, we also have to look at the accountability. The National American Woman Suffrage Association, which was the two groups that merged in 1889, they began to make the argument, give women the vote, because white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants, and woman suffrage is a way to maintain white, native-born supremacy. They practiced states' rights. They allowed the state auxiliaries to segregate, to work for the vote for white women only, and to work for the Jim Crow laws, the voter suppression laws. So I think that, you know, as we look at the voting patterns today, we may really look at what is the legacy of the woman suffrage movement, both in its positive but also in its negative impact.
And the southern bloc of states that refused to ratify the 19th Amendment, that part of their logic was they didn't want to reinforce African Americans' women's ability to vote. That was...
Yes.
And so today, when women do have the opportunity to vote, who should they be remembering? Who do they tip their hat to? What name should be in their frontal lobe as they cast their ballot?
Yes, I think that there are many. We tend to only know these big names of our foremothers. Sally has brought many more names to us in her book. I bring some of the lesser-known suffragists, and these include men. There are many brave men who stand up for us in this long, long battle, whether in Congress or in the states or in the press, who support the movement when it's not very, very popular.
Right, so we're out of time. I got to say thank you so much to our guest, Elaine Weiss. Her book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. That's going to be made a movie with Steven Spielberg, Sally Rush Wagner, The Women's Suffrage Movement. This is The Source.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is produced by Kim Johnson, Jan Ross Piedad, and David Martin Davies. Production assistance is provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.